Good morning. Delighted to welcome you all to our and the last oral argument in September. And we are especially delighted to welcome students from Banner Preparatory. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Courtlet Class. It's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from high schools around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they are given materials about the case and may engage in various activities relating to the case. They then come to the court and hear the oral argument, and after the oral argument, they are invited to join a justice of the court in discussing the procedures the court uses to take and decide cases. The substantive issues of the case are not discussed. Everyone's invited to join with the students in this discussion, and it will be held immediately after this oral argument. If anyone would like a summary of the facts of this case and the issues, the marshal can give you that synopsis. So if you'd raise your hand if you'd like a summary, we can give one to you. I'm glad you're all prepared. Court is prepared to. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. You will meet with Justice Rogensack after this case. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductory remarks, I'll call our case 08AP10, Mark Solowich versus Forward Geneva National. Arguing on behalf of Mrs. Solowich is Brad L.F. Is it Haitian? You will argue for 25 minutes. Then John Brady will have 20 minutes to argue for Geneva National Rental Corporation. 10 minutes, John Nielsen, who will argue for the Amicus Curiae, Wisconsin Realtors Association. And you will have 5 minutes representing Mr. Solowich in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, Madam Chief Justice. My name is Brad Heschen, and I'm an attorney with Greenberg and Heschen in Milwaukee. Also present from my firm are attorneys Jordana Tomadson and Martin Greenberg. We represent the plaintiff appellant petitioners in this case, Mark Solowich, Stephen Havey, and Jesse Soltis, who are also present in court today. We are here today asking the court to reverse the decision of the Walworth County Circuit Court and the Second District Court of Appeals, and thereby giving a voice in the management of Geneva National to the unit owners, nearly 1,000 of them, as well as to the declarant, in accordance with the ownership interest held by that declarant. In order to reach that decision, we ask that the court strike Article 9 of the Declaration of Covenants, Conditions, Restrictions, and Easements at Geneva National. That provision gives the declarant the power to control the community association. We also ask that the court strike portions of Articles 4, 5, and 11, which allow the declarant to carry out those powers and give the trust unfettered assessment authority. In order to arrive there, we ask the court first to consider Wisconsin Statute Section 703. and the protections it gives to individuals who own condominiums in Wisconsin. We ask the court to consider the application of those provisions and how the declarant attempts to undermine those protections with the restrictive covenant in this case. Second, we ask the court to reaffirm the nearly 90-year history of the requirement of reasonableness in Wisconsin when enforcing restrictive covenants. Third, we ask the court to find as a matter of law that this restrictive covenant is unreasonable. And finally, we ask the court to determine that this restrictive covenant is not sufficiently definite to be enforced.
Mr. Hashin, let me, if I might, interrupt you for a minute. One of the problems that I have with this case is that when I look at the cases in regard to reasonableness, they appear to me to be all over the map. I don't see a clear case that controls the issue of whether or not we should or should not apply a reasonableness standard. Can you guide me in that regard? Can you tell me what your position is?
Yes, Mrs. Crooks, we would direct the court to the very first case on this issue, Huntley versus Stanchfield. Huntley was decided in 1921 by the Supreme Court, and it established a three-pronged test for determining whether or not a restrictive covenant is reasonable. In Huntley, the court determined that a restrictive covenant must serve a just purpose, that it must serve legitimate interests, and that it must be reasonable between the parties. The Huntley decision was followed by nearly a dozen...
Counsel, if I might, I think you have to just tell us simply what the facts were. Was it a restrictive covenant in employment? Was it a restrictive covenant relating to trade? Was it a covenant of architectural control? I think that when you parse these cases, what the fact situation was and how it arose makes a difference. So,
thank you, Madam Chief. I'm happy to.
Okay, tell us what Huntley was.
I'm sorry?
What was Huntley?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking for the facts in this case.
No, I know the facts. I think I know the facts. I hope I know the facts.
Sure.
Tell me what Huntley was.
In Huntley, the court explained that the property conveyed was not to be used as a hotel for a period of 15 years.
It was a use restriction.
It was a
use
restriction.
Real estate. Okay.
That's correct. The court continued to follow the path in Huntley for nearly 9 decades in restrictive covenants. The court followed with cases like Doherty versus Rice and McKinnon versus Benedict. It wasn't until the Perch decision where the defendants in this case argue that the Second District Court of Appeal changed the standard for reasonableness. In Perch versus Upper Oconomowoc Lake Association, the Second District Court of Appeals reviewed whether or not an architectural review committee could use reasonableness as the standard for determining the enforceability of a certain kind of covenant. Specifically in Perch, an individual wished to build a boathouse that was detached from the primary residence. Although there was no specific language in the restrictive covenant, the Architectural Review Committee wanted to use reasonableness as its standard. That is entirely different from the case we have before the court today. In the present case, we are asking the court to determine whether or not a covenant itself is enforceable because it is unreasonable.
Mr. Hashin, even if we say you're right, there should be a reasonableness standard. The Court of Appeals basically did that, didn't they? They said, okay, we don't know if it's got to be reasonableness or not. We don't think so. But they then proceeded to do a reasonableness analysis. If we do the same thing, why would we come out differently than the Court of Appeals? What's unreasonable about what's going on here?
There are a variety of items that are unreasonable. Perhaps the most important, however, is the long-term control that the declarant has had at Geneva National. Geneva National was formed in 1990. It was comprised of approximately 1,600 acres, and it currently contains approximately 2,000 condominium units. Approximately 1,000 of those have been conveyed to individuals. The declarant at Geneva National has retained unfettered control, and the restrictive covenant says it ruled in its sole and absolute discretion since 1990, for 19 years. Justice Crooks, I would assert to the court that on its face alone, is unreasonable. But that is not the only unreasonable circumstance that surfaces for the court here today. The unit owners in this case, Mark Solowitz, Stephen Havey, and Jesse Soltis, each purchased their properties in the 1990s. Mr. Solowitz in 1995, and Mr. Havey and Mr. Soltis in 1999. They purchased, understanding that there was a prohibition on the construction of timeshare condominiums at Geneva National. Yet in 2005, the declarant reversed that restriction, allowing for the construction of timeshares at Geneva National. It did so without a vote of the unit owners. It did so without consulting with the mortgagees as required by Wisconsin Statute Section 703. That was an unreasonable change, an unreasonable amendment to the requirements at Geneva National. Additionally, the declarant has retained unfettered assessment power. The declarant has assessed the unit owners at Geneva National for every penny of the cost of this litigation. The declarant has assessed the unit owners at Geneva National for the construction of a $1 million front gate that provides direct access to the declarant's office. All of those assessments were made without a vote of the unit owners. Additionally, the declarant retains the ability to remove any individual who is a member of the board of directors if that member of the board of directors acts in a manner that is prejudicial to the declarant at the declarant's sole and absolute discretion. There is simply one example after another of the manner in which these restrictions are unreasonable. But Wisconsin Statute Section 703 also provides us with a standard of determining what is reasonable. The statute, which was provided by the legislature to provide both protections as well as to give unit owners an understanding of their obligations when they own a condominium, establishes a reasonable period of time when the declarant must turn over control of a condominium association and a condominium development to the unit owners. The legislature determined that that reasonable amount of time is a maximum of 10 years. While there are other conditions under which control can be turned over to the unit owners, in no event can the control be retained by the declarant for more than a period of 10 years.
Could I inquire, if you struck Article 9, what happens then?
Control of the community association turns over to the unit owners. Justice Prosser, Article 9 contemplates the turnover of the control of the community association at some point in time. Specifically, it says that when 85% of the units at Geneva National have been conveyed, the declarant no longer retains control. By striking Article 9, the court is turning over control now, after more than 19 years have passed and the declarant has had unfettered control of the property.
What is the community association control then?
The community association controls the ability to amend the declaration of the restrictive covenant. It controls the ability to make assessments on the individual unit owners at Geneva National. The community association currently controls the ability to approve other developments. So it's important that the unit owners now have a voice.
Well, would it control, say, a golf course?
The golf course is a condominium, and each of the condominium associations operate of their own accord, but the community association has the ability, for instance, to make assessments. In addition, the restrictive covenant gives the community association the ability to both approve and disapprove of amendments to the individual condominium declarations at each condominium association. So if the golf course wished to pass a declaration to allow for golf to start earlier in the season, for instance, that would have to be approved by the community association before it could take place. In addition, if the golf course wished to pass an assessment to increase the amount of greens fees, that would also have to be approved by the community association as a whole. The declarations of condominium at Geneva National, and there are 32 of them at the 32 residential condominium associations, are all subordinated to the restrictive covenant. The restrictive covenant states so, and so does each of the individual declarations. So the control of the community association reaches down into those individual associations and restricts what it is they can and cannot do without permission of the association.
So it basically turns the condominium owners into golf course owners, restaurant owners, hotel owners, and control of the entire facility?
It gives the unit owners a vote on each of the issues that come before the community association. Remember that the golf course owners are also condominium unit owners, and so they retain a vote as well.
Do these people really want to pay for all those things? The hotel, the restaurant, the golf course, and the upkeep of all of those things?
They currently pay for it now. And their point is that since we are paying for it, we should have a role in determining what those costs are going to be. What we're really asking the court to do, Justice Ziegler, is weigh the interests of one individual declarant who holds all the power against those interests of more than 1,000 individual unit owners, both residential unit owners, commercial unit owners, and golf course owners.
What about the 85%? Should we just forget about that? That was
Well, we think that there are a number of reasons that the court can find that the 85% is not important, because it is not reasonable and because it does not comply with Section 703. However, if the court is interested in making a determination as to whether or not they've reached 85%, there are a number of ways that the court could make that determination.
I guess what you're going to have to convince me of is that this entire planned unit community falls under 703. That's one of the things that's going to be critical to me, because 703 is for condos.
Right.
And, well, you can start with that.
Okay. I'm really happy to talk about that, because I think that is the crux of this case before you today. There are a number of reasons that it doesn't fall under 703, but that the attempt to vitiate 703 by creating the restrictive covenant needs to be halted.
Does it matter at all that the restrictive covenants were actually filed before the declaration, the 703 declaration, even if it's just a day? I mean, these people were on notice, were they not?
Well, while they received a copy of the restrictive covenant because it was recorded against their land, they also received a copy of the declaration, which says that the developer has elected, it's not mandatory in Wisconsin, has elected to place the property under the provisions of Wisconsin Statute Section 703. The time in which they were recorded is not important. And the reason it is not is because the protections of Section 703 apply. And therefore, any attempt to vitiate them, whether done before or after the recording of the restrictive covenant, is one that needs to be thwarted, because 703 is designed to provide protections.
So your position is, if you've got a condo and it falls under 703, and this does, and there is a condo declaration, and there's no question about that, then you can, then the entire 1,600 acres is governed by that, by Chapter 703.
If the entire 1,600 acres has a declaration of condominium recorded against it, then the entire 1,600 acres is governed by Section 703.
Well, does the declaration of condominiums cover the 1,600 acres?
It does not cover all 1,600 acres, because there are some undeveloped portions.
Right.
All of the developed portions at Geneva National are condominiums. There is a commercial condominium, there is a golf course condominium, there are the residential condominiums. So all of the portions that have individual unit owners are condominiums.
What is your argument? Is your argument that the restrictive covenant comes under 703 and the protections of 703 apply there? Or is it that the restrictive covenant vitiates the protections that are otherwise available under 703 to condominium owners?
We have argued both positions to the court, but the position that I think the court needs to pay most attention to today is that the restrictive covenant does vitiate and undermine the protections allowed for in Section 703. that the unit owners are led to believe that they have protections on the term of declarant control, on the declarant's ability to amend the declaration and to place assessments, and yet the restrictive covenant takes that away. Well, so it is that protection that we are asking the court to allow to and to provide to the unit owners.
But then you really undercut and totally disbelieve and don't accept the Court of Appeals concept that this is a master planned community. That a master planned community can, to use your words, I won't use your words. I won't say it vitiates the condo, but it changes the rules, and that you can have an umbrella association, an umbrella view under a master plan community. And that under a master plan community, you have to allow the developer a relatively free hand. This is part of the amicus brief too.
Yes.
A relatively free hand so that the development, and you agree there's a lot here that hasn't been developed,
yes,
that it can be developed, and that the developers put in a lot of money, and that's why you need this power. You also take issue with the fact that I think it comes through clearly in the Court of Appeals, your clients were on notice. This was a long document, over 60 pages, right? Typed single space for the most part. So when you get a document that's 60 pages of typed single space stuff, you know you're facing a lot of conditions. And your clients bought it, and why aren't they tagged with those conditions?
Yes, ma'am. I'll answer both of those questions. Let me take the first one first about the umbrella document, the restrictive covenant. A restrictive covenant is perfectly appropriate in a community of condominium associations. I would add that we don't buy into the definition of master planned community. Nothing in the documents given to our clients suggests that it is a master planned community. Rather, it's just a community of condominium associations. But there's nothing wrong with a restrictive covenant that governs that community, so long as the restrictive covenant doesn't vitiate the protections otherwise given to the unit owners in Wisconsin Statute Section 703. We would direct the court, as a matter of fact, and I think this also goes to answer Justice Ziegler's question, to the Fox and Brandon Farms cases from New Jersey. Those two persuasive cases explain that restrictive covenants are perfectly appropriate so long as they don't take away protections that were otherwise allocated to individual unit owners. In Fox, for instance, the court made a determination that there was reaching into the individual community associations from those common elements, and that that was prohibited by the statute, the lingering control by virtue of having long-term leases there.
Counselor, just so I'm clear on the facts, you have this 1,600-acre parcel, and then you have different condominium associations within that 1,600-acre confine, correct?
That's correct.
Well, if there's not some overriding document that pertains to them all, couldn't each individual condominium association decide that it's in their best interest to do one thing, but it may not be in the best interest of another condominium association within this confine? So what's to govern that?
You're right. That would certainly create an internal conflict between the associations. And that's why the Fox and Brandon Farms cases says it's appropriate to have restrictive covenants. And we agree that in Wisconsin, it's appropriate to have an umbrella document that covers the condominium associations. The catch is that umbrella document cannot take away protections that are otherwise allowed for in Section 703.
And what protection, part of it is the 75% versus 85%, those are the protections you're talking about.
As well as the 10 years as opposed to practically unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
And your umbrella organization, you're coming under, you say, 703-155-7. Is that right?
Correct.
Now, what about this concept? Should you prevail, then is this whole restrictive covenant gone so that nothing governs, that there is no umbrella association? What takes the place if you should win?
Right. Nothing takes the place. The document stays where it is. This court ruled last term in Star Direct that restrictive covenants are severable. While Star Direct was an employment case, it clearly applies here, where the court can remove those portions of the restrictive covenant that are offensive. We think the Star Direct case is directly on point, such that the court can remove the portion that is creating the problem and vitiating the statute. I would also point out...
Which of the portions? I mean, Article 9?
Article 9, we're asking be stricken in total.
And what's going to take its place?
Well, what takes its place is the operation of the individual unit owners. Nothing takes its place. What Article 9 accounted for, Chief Justice, is the manner in which control turned over from the declarant to the individual unit owners. What the court does by striking Article 9 is turn over that control. Now, that question also plays into the declarant's argument here that the sky is falling, that if the court takes away these portions that condominium unit owners from across the state will start flooding the courts. There are two reasons that's not true. The first is this document calls for the orderly turnover of control from the declarant to the unit owners. And secondly, Wisconsin has had its reasonableness standard from Huntley since 1921.
Huntley was portrayed as restricting the use of a hotel. The court portrayed that as a restraint of trade case, not a property kind of restriction, although it's obviously both, and then applied the usual rule in restraint of trade, whether it's Little Sherman Act or otherwise, of reasonableness. So Huntley does not quite fit this case.
Well, if the court takes that position, then the court can follow the path of cases that have continued to evolve in Wisconsin. In Doherty versus Rice, the court explains that based on a racial restriction, reasonable restrictions will be enforced. In McKinnon versus Benedict, the court determined that a loan for the purchase of property that was conditioned on the filing and reporting that says no trees will be cut down for 25 years is not enforceable because it is not reasonable.
It was almost unconscionable in the McKinnon case.
I would agree. I would also think that more...
The general concept of contract law.
Well, that's true. But the McKinnon court did adopt the three-prong reasonableness test that was used in Huntley. The other thing that I think is important about the continuation of the reasonableness test is that after the Perch decision in 2001, the Second District Court of Appeals then adopted the Huntley provisions in Wieland, which came down in 2002. The reasonableness standard continues to survive. And judges,
is it reasonable? Do we judge reasonableness at the time the documents are put together and recorded, or we judge reasonableness at the time they're executed, or do we judge reasonableness day by day, depending on what is being complained of?
We judge reasonableness based on the terms of the documents themselves.
When?
At the time they are drafted.
Okay.
And what we have provided to the court in this case is examples of how the documents were unreasonable at the time they were drafted.
Counsel, I have to ask you this. Would your argument be any different if instead of 1,000 of 2,000 units being occupied, we had 10 of 20 units on the same parcel being occupied?
No, Justice Ziegler, I only represent three of those individual unit owners, and it is unreasonable to the three of those unit owners regardless of how many there are.
So if there were 20 units, they should control the entire community logic as well.
If the time has passed, if the time period has passed under Section 703, or the restrictive covenants were otherwise unreasonable, it doesn't matter how many unit owners there are, the restrictive covenant should be stricken. I did want to get back to the issue of justice. I'm sorry.
Well, your red light is on, so if you would save that. I'm sorry. You will save that, but Justice Prosser has a question.
Thank you. I have to ask this question. What is the proper title of this case? What is the proper caption of this case?
The full caption, Justice Prosser? Is that what the court is asking?
What?
It's Mark Solowitz, Stephen Havey, and Jesse Soltis versus Forward Geneva National. That's how the case was originally captioned. The defendants at that time made a motion to add additional parties. The plaintiffs then...
What I'm trying to get at is Court of Appeals starts with Solowitz.
Correct.
And all the briefs seem to start with Havey.
Oh, I...
The caption of your brief is Havey, Solovich, and Soltis. You did it alphabetically, counsel.
Okay, I apologize.
Does it matter
so
to, does it
we
matter
go
to
with Solovich.
Yes.
One way or the other,
does not matter
we go
to
with Solovich.
The Second District Court of Appeals has referred to, what referred to in its decision, Mr. Solovich.
How is it published? I didn't look at the published opinion.
Let me see here.
No, you're looking at your own briefs. I want to know how
no,
they
have,
published.
I have the published opinion attached in the appendix.
All right.
It is referred to as Mark J. Solowitz, Jesse E. Soltis, and Stephen J. Havey plaintiffs' appellants.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr.
Brady, Attorney Brady, representing Geneva National Retail Corporation.
Apologize for that. Actually, Your Honor, I am John Brady of Weiss Brzozowski Brady. May it please the Court. I am appearing for and on behalf of Geneva National Trust. There may be some, I have not appeared on behalf of Geneva National Retail Association.
Is it Maddie? There's a whole list of defendant respondents. Who's
there? I'm here.
You're here.
Yeah, that's really all.
You're going to take them all on,
I'll
right?
take them all.
All right.
But actually, I don't represent them all, which is one of the benefits of this case. I am pleased and lucky enough to represent the Trust and Forward Geneva National, the declarant. I am also pleased to have Attorney Bush Nielsen on behalf of the Realtors Association as the amicus curiae. And also with us today, Your Honor, is Attorney Tom Devine, who represents the Geneva National Condominium Master Association, Lyle Blackburn of Lake Geneva, who represents the Geneva National Community Association, Attorney Richard Torhorst, who's also sitting here, who represents and has appeared throughout this case representing undeveloped landowners. So what we have, Your Honor, and quite frankly, is when this case was started, the case was brought simply against the then declarant, and Judge Gibbs, in a wonderful decision, and I would have obviously suggest that all of Judge Gibbs' decisions have been wonderful.
all those kids are above average.
And his kids are, kids are above average. Determined that all landowners in Geneva National and all interested parties were necessary parties. And because of that, the Community Association has had the opportunity to appear and voice its objections to the positions espoused by the plaintiff appellants for the reasons as it affects their day-to-day and long-term operation of the property. The Master Condominium Association has had its opportunity to address Judge Gibbs on its interests in thwarting the claims of the plaintiff appellants. Obviously, the undeveloped landowners and the declarant have taken that same position, but we have had a full vetting of the community and the concerns of the community on the issues proposed by the plaintiff appellants, and this has now become statewide because the Wisconsin Realtors Association has appeared, and it rarely does at the trial court level, but consistently throughout the appeals and before this court, and is concerned that the positions espoused, having really no factual basis whatsoever, will have a drastic
Sir,
and draconian
kind of like
effect
to,
on...
I'd like to direct your comments to the issue that concerns me most,
okay.
And that is if there is, if we were to determine that Article 9 is unambiguous, do we still have to determine whether or not it's reasonable? If you say yes, what are the criteria for making that determination? And obviously, if you say no, then that's the end of that concern. So if you could address that for me, please.
Surely. If the opinion, the Wisconsin law has consistently been that if the restrictive covenants are clear and unambiguous, then covenants, for example, under the Seiler case, and contracts, and the rule of parole evidence, is that they must be enforced, and there is no issue of reasonableness appropriate for this court to make. If it would be appropriate, then any contract or covenant that is entered into between parties can at any time be challenged on the grounds of reasonableness. And there is no enforceability of contracts in the first instance, because reasonable is simply in the eyes of the holder. Is a glass of beer half empty or half full? Is it reasonable or unreasonable?
But there is an overriding concept of unconscionability.
Oh, absolutely, and I believe Mr. Nielsen will address it also, but Wisconsin law, Justice Heffernan, in the McKinnon case, said this is unconscionable. If the argument of the plaintiff appellants were that the actions of the declarant and the various principals was oppressive or unconscionable, absolutely.
And that's just being very, very, very unreasonable. That makes it unconscionable, isn't it?
I don't know how many varies it takes, right. But there is a significant difference between unconscionability in the McKinnon case and the very concept, and by the way, Chapter 703 doesn't apply, but the very concept that exists in Chapter 03 in the first instance. We're told that declarant control is unreasonable, whereas in Chapter 703 there is declarant control up to 10 years. We're told that it's unreasonable for a declarant to remove a board member. Chapter 703 permits that very claim of unreasonableness. Now,
Mr. Brady, does the enforcement have to be reasonable? You've told us that if it's clear and unambiguous in regard to the restrictions, then they must be enforced. Now, I've read arguments that the enforcement has to be reasonable. Is that the same as the unconscionability test? What are we talking about there?
That's a very good question, because the issue has come up in various fashions. When you're dealing, there is no claim of enforcement here. But if, for example, a unit owner violated one of the tenets of the either the restrictive covenant, flying a flag. We decide there's a statute that now applies, but at that time, flying the flag. And if the community association said no, certainly the court would say, well, while the declaration, the restrictive covenants prohibit flag waving, that is unreasonable. That, and we're not going to enjoin it. And it's the refusal to enjoin because of the equitable powers of the court in entering an injunction that apply, which is really what the majority of the, which was what Lefebvre and McKinnon are all about. Those are injunction cases. They have nothing to do with what we call deed restrictions. One's a condo case, one's an adjoining neighbor case where he was taken advantage of by a very good lawyer. And Heffernan would have nothing to do with it.
The answer to Justice Crooks' question of does enforcement have to be reasonable, what's that answer?
The answer is yes. Enforcement, it can't be unreasonable. The courts have ruled that they will not enforce a provision which is unreasonable.
That means I want to stay focused on this reasonableness and the provisions we have in Chapter 9, and give you a hypothetical. We're now, in this hypothetical, 19 years from the commencement of this restrictive covenant being filed. And let's say the developer stopped developing any new houses or condos, stopped developing anything, no new units were sold. And you take this 19 years and you move it ahead, and now someone comes into court 30 years later, but we haven't yet hit the 85% of the maximum number of units. They have not yet been sold. Can an argument be made that the terms of the restrictive covenant are unreasonable, or is it your position, as long as the language is clear and unambiguous, then no argument regarding unreasonableness may be advanced?
It's a very good question. First of all, that isn't the issue before the court. It wasn't the issue before.
It's not the issue before the court, but it's what the Court of Appeals talked about in paragraph 48 of its opinion, and so I want to ask about it.
I don't believe that the court, absent unconscionability and various other legal defenses, has the ability to vitiate a contract, and a covenant is a contract. So if, in fact, the developer declarant had been in good faith trying to develop for that 40-year period, and crops weren't growing, I don't believe the court would have any power to intervene. However, you do get provisions, for example, even under restrictive covenants of a change of circumstances. If, in fact, the developer isn't developing, then the purpose of the covenant in the first instance doesn't exist. And Justice Wilkie, for example, in the Vorpal case, held that if the character has changed, then the court can affect a change in the restrictive covenant. So I will agree with you, but for a different reason, and that is that there's been a change of circumstances.
Let me follow up, if I may. The end of paragraph 47 of the Court of Appeals opinion, the last sentence used the term as a matter of law. And to me, that's kind of they didn't have to say that. But they used those words for a reason. It says, therefore, we cannot find the covenant is unreasonable as a matter of law. The next paragraph starts, this case would be different. However, and then it gives a couple of examples, and one of the examples is, this case would be different if the developer continued its control years after development and new homes stopped, even if 85% of the maximum number of units had not yet been sold. I read the Court of Appeals opinion to say, under the facts, that here you're not going to say it's unreasonable as a matter of law, but under different facts, it could be held to be unreasonable. And the fact that they set forth in paragraph 48 is as I read. Do you agree with the Court of Appeals statement in paragraph 48 that under other facts, as they set forth, it could be unreasonable?
I believe, Your Honor, that the court could determine something to be unreasonable, but it doesn't follow that a contract or a covenant that is unreasonable can be vitiated by the court, because there is the sanctity of contract, which is what a covenant is in the first instance. The court could refuse to enforce it, but it can't vitiate it.
What should a court 30 years down the road in the Court of Appeals statement in paragraph 48 do if the developer continued its control after development and new home sales stopped, even if 85% of the maximum number of units had not yet been sold? Wouldn't we then conceivably have a lawsuit before us asking for a declaratory judgment that the restrictive covenant should not be enforced because it's unreasonable under the facts?
No. I think I've answered the question once already, Your Honor. I believe that if that state of facts existed, the plaintiff would have the right to come before the court and say, do not enforce it, but not because it's unreasonable, but because of change of circumstances.
The change of circumstance, what's the theory of law? Changing. We get cases all the time. The facts change, but then you got to tie it into a theory.
No, Your Honor, because a restrictive covenant is created with a specific purpose in mind. And when that and this one was, and frankly, if I got to the argument, every restrictive covenant case has come down on the side of enforcing a general scheme for the mutual benefit of the participants. This one has a general purpose also. One of the purposes is the development of this project. If they cease developing it, that would be a change in circumstances, and there would be no purpose for the covenant in the first instance. It's not because it's unreasonable. My wife thinks I'm unreasonable. That's not a reason to act. There has to be some legal basis for it.
Now, let me just see if I can summarize your argument.
Pardon? I didn't hear you, Your Honor.
Let me just see if I understand your argument by summarizing. Your argument, as I hear it, is that what we're dealing with here is a contract. And that the usual rules of contract apply. And that the usual rules of contract are that the parties, assuming there's no compulsion, no fraud and misrepresentation, is that the parties made the deal, they're stuck with it. There are times where the court will undo the deal. They might do it if it's unconscionable. They may do it if it contravenes statute, contravenes public policy, change of circumstances so it's not reasonable or conscionable to now enforce the contract. So we should apply straight contract rules. And that doesn't include restraint of trade rules. Right?
Right.
And one of the rules is you construe a statute that controls the use of real estate narrowly because the public policy is to allow free use by the owners, right? And that is your position. And your position here is that this doesn't fall into any usual contract rule that shows that the plain language of the deal should not be covered.
I would agree with that position 100%.
I think it's what I hear you telling me now. I get a little mixed up in your position on in answer to Justice Cook's question. He said to you, as I understood that question, what about if the enforcement of a reasonable provision is unreasonable? That's what I understood the question. And then it's enforced by the declarant here, or the Architectural Control Committee, or whatever it is. And so the restriction is quite reasonable on its face, but they are enforcing it unreasonably. And I think your answer to him moved from the declarant's reasonable enforcement and the court's enforcement. So let's talk about the declarant. And I think that that raises the issue of assessing without any consent for $1 million, building the gate without any approval, et cetera.
If I could, I'll answer the question, but there are some misstatements which really confuse everything.
Okay.
I do have before the court Exhibit 2, a governance chart. And that governance chart is based upon the finding of Judge Gibbs and the Court of Appeals and sets out who's on first and who does what.
I thought the Court of Appeals did a pretty good job. Do you agree with it?
And what was stated by the appellants was the declarant assessment. The declarant doesn't assess anything. All assessments come from three different sources. One, the community association, not the declarant, assesses for the cost of the common element. And they assess all property owners. The condominium master condominium association assesses the residential condominiums and the multifamily and single for the cost of maintaining the footprint of their condominium. In this instance, the trust has the ability to assess, not the unit owners, but the community association, for the cost of defending the declaration of restrictions in the first instance. There is no assessment whatsoever permitted by the declarant. The declarant is not in control.
Well, but the declarant can get rid of everybody on the community association, isn't that right?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The declarant can get rid of all the members of the community association.
It could, but it hasn't.
I know it hasn't, but it could. That's the issue.
But I don't think that makes the representatives of single-family property owners.
You're saying the assessments were reasonably enforced by groups upon which the three plaintiffs had representation, especially
okay.
the community
I'm saying that the declarant okay. has four votes out of 19 on the community association. The declarant is not in control. If you say, well, yes, the declarant could fire everybody and start over, it hasn't.
So your argument is they were reasonably enforcing this?
Absolutely.
Okay, but let's talk about the principle of if they're unreasonably enforcing the covenant.
Well,
does the court look at that?
I think there is a constitutional right to due process, but that constitutional right to due process arrives in the court. I don't think it applies to, in this instance, not the declarant, but the director of the community association, which is a hired employee. He is hired to enforce the will of the five directors of this corporation. And yes, corporations act unreasonably. And that's why we have courts. And that's why the courts either apply due process or not. And that's why in McKinnon, the court said, Court of Equity isn't going to touch this one. That's why in Lefebvre, the court said the Court of Equity isn't going to touch this one. In fact, that's why in Presch, the Court of Appeals said, no, we're not going to touch this one either. We're not going to approve your expanding the jurisdiction of this restrictive covenant to do things that weren't set out in the first instance. So I think it, yes, Justice.
Mr. Brady, if we sort of assumed that the entire space in this hearing were 1,600 acres, your position is that a restrictive covenant could be filed for covering these entire 1,600 acres. Now let's say we're just talking about this desk over here, and there were two condominiums. Could the declarant have a restrictive covenant for just two condominiums?
No.
Why not?
Because that isn't the plan. I mean, if you're asking, could we have, in 1990, could they have drafted it that way? Yes. But that isn't the way they drafted it. They said, we've got the state of Texas. We've got 1,600 acres. That's almost the state of Texas in Walworth County. And we're going to do this as a master plan community. And we've got to have rules that apply to everything. We've got to figure out how the roads work and how the sewer works and how the water works and what the grading is going to be. And we're going to pass those rules. And that's what we have in those 60 acres. I'm proud to be able to represent it. I didn't draft it. It's one of the best drafted documents I've read. And then we have separate individual condos. For example, one of the plaintiffs has 4 acres with 68 residential units. The declarant has no power. The community association has no power whatsoever over that condominium and that condominium association. They can do anything they want there. They can change the rules. But that 4-acre condominium can't look at the state of Texas and say, we're now in control, which is what's happening here.
I heard a lot of words, but I didn't understand the answer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now look, okay. This is blank, or not blank, this is vacant land. This is a potential developer declarant. She wants to build magnificent condominiums, but only two of them, and it's going to be a tight little community, and they're going to terrace this, and they're going to have beautiful roads and gardens and maybe even a tennis court. It's just two condominiums. Why can't she have a restrictive covenant?
She wants to build those in Geneva National, so I understand it?
No, just anywhere.
She does, under real estate property law, she doesn't need one, because if she's doing a condominium, she simply takes that desk and condos it, and the condominium can also contain the very same covenants that a restrictive covenant does.
Mr. Brady, do I hear you saying that your clients would only be concerned about that desk insofar if it was a part of the planned community, and if so, how it would impact the ultimate vision or the ultimate uniformity of development of the community?
That's a fair statement.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Bradley.
As I understand it, the community association has five classes of voting members that constitute the board of directors. And each class elects a representative. Is that right? Or
that's generally right, yes.
I mean, there are, one class is the club owners. Another class is the, I think, the golf club or commercial property owners and a couple of other classes. Okay. And so those, generally speaking, those classes, five classes, can each elect a representative, and each representative may cast four votes.
Chapter one, yes, three.
Okay, thank you. Now, article and those, and the board of directors has a number of powers, which include they can obtain loans, they can levy assessments on property owners, etc. Now, Article 9 gives the developer the power to, as I understand it, the power to remove and appoint the board of directors.
That's true.
So what if the developer, that's not the case here, but what if under the terms of these documents, the developer decides to remove the duly elected representative of each of those classes, the club owners, the golf course folks, the commercial property folks, and replace them with members of his own family, assuming they were also a club owner or a golf club, a person or a commercial property. Can the developer do that without being subject to any cause of action because the words of Section 9 give him the authority to appoint and remove?
I only chuckle, by the way, because right now the city of Lake Geneva mayor has fired all the aldermen, and it's pretty much left under in court.
And the mayor's family, his kids,
his okay. Own handpicked aldermen now. And okay. One of the attorneys who, in this case, isn't here because he's now representing those aldermen who were fired, so it's just coincidental, you ask.
Let me say by preface that, it would cause me to pause in this big operation if someone could fire the duly elected people and appoint them with their own family members. There's a certain smell test to that, but beyond the smell test, I'm interested in what's the law and what the document says. Under the document, could that happen, and would there be subject to any reasonableness analysis?
It's a very good question. By the way, the condominium, Chapter 703, permits it for 10 years. So the concept of removing a director that's it's appropriate, I think it's ridiculous. And if my client came to me, as I put in the brief, I'd be hard-pressed to tell him to do it because I think he would look stupid. But I don't think there is any legal disenfranchisement of any rights if that occurs. So I don't believe it violates any existing statutory provision or constitutional provision, and while incredibly stupid, well, I don't know how you would prohibit it.
You don't think, would you apply a reasonable standard?
That's my question.
Madam Chief Justice, I'd apply the unconscionable standard. I mean, that's ultimate stupidity.
Okay. Well, you'd apply the stupidity standard.
Stupidity. That's all you can say.
If I can ask Justice Prosser's question just a little bit differently, okay. And it's a short one, and I think we'll get a short response. If you have only a condominium on a parcel of property, even if it's a big parcel of property, can you have both a restrictive covenant and a declaration document under 703, and which trumps which?
Well, absolutely. First of all, you can have both. In fact, you have these all the time, because you not only have a restrictive covenant, I'm sure you have 17 easements, and you have something else. What trumps what? First, in Wisconsin, first to file, usually that's going to be the easements, then it will be the restrictive covenant, and then it will be the declaration of condominium. If I were a lazy or stupid lawyer and made the mistake of recording the declaration of condominium first, and I still have my hot little restrictive covenant in my hand, I can enter into an agreement to subordinate, which creates the same effect. I mean, the nice thing about real estate law and contract law, it's, for lawyers like me, it's like playing with building blocks. It's very simple and it's very predictable. That's how we do things. I mean, this development is property one. You create a restrictive covenant which covers Texas. Then you create condominiums, or it could be meets and bounds, lots, with a different, in a subordinate set of rules, because all of them are different. One multifamily condominium is certainly different than the golf course. It's certainly different than the commercial in another location. So, I mean, this is property one.
Well, but the question is really whether the restrictive covenant, where we're dealing with just Justice Prosser's and Justice Ziegler's example, can that restrictive covenant be in violation in any manner to 703?
Yes. Yes. But I say violation. Is it contradictory of 703? The answer is yes. It can be contradictory to 703. But because the condominium is subordinate to it. Would it be in... I'm trying to think of a situation where you could have a provision in a restrictive covenant. Let me give you one that perhaps could exist. They cite the Doherty case. The Doherty case said no Caucasians can live here. If the restrictive covenant, and this is in 1948, said no Caucasians can live there, and the condominium documents said non-Caucasians can live here, you have a constitutional argument there.
Well, the fact that they're inconsistent. I can't think of an example, and the 85% won't work on the basis of we're dealing with one piece of property. But it would seem to me that we have the whole property governed by a condo agreement and being governed by 703. It would be very hard to have a second document that would govern the same area and not conform to Chapter 703.
Well, I would agree with that. You asked me if it was possible, and the question was, couldn't we have both? The answer is yes, it is possible, and yes, you could have both. I don't know a real estate lawyer in the world who would do it that way, but yes, you can record multiple layers.
If I may, I thought I understood you to say that the restrictive covenant could not only cover Texas, it could cover Rhode Island, and it would supersede Chapter 703 on Rhode Island. That's what I understood you to say.
No, Your Honor, I didn't say that at all. I said, if I did, then I misspoke. A restrictive covenant covers, in this instance, 1,600 acres. That's what it does. A condominium covers that a portion of that 1,600 acres, 11 acres. This restrictive covenant permits that condominium to be much like, for example, Monaco or the Vatican. It's a principality. It is in Italy, but for that local area, it is supreme. The declarant has no power over that 4-acre condominium comprising a part of the 1,600-acre assessments for that condominium are made by its association. It runs itself. The declarant can, the restrictive covenant declarant, cannot change the declaration of condominium. That's owned by that principality. So, to answer your question from that perspective, no, since the restrictive covenants do not have the power to modify or amend the governance documents of every condominium, no, they can't thwart Chapter 703. And if I misspoke because of that, I apologize. But
and you're saying if the restrictive covenant on vacant land were filed first and then condominiums came along, the thing would be under Chapter 703.
No, I'm trying to. Could you ask? I don't understand the question. I mean, if the restrictive covenant is filed first, it's a restrictive covenant. The restrictive covenant never becomes Chapter 703 because it doesn't meet any of the statutory tests of Chapter 703. A condominium can be filed on it, and that's quite all right. The best way to describe it maybe is to look at the United States. We have the federal system, which is supreme. You have the states, which have their own rights to pass laws. They can't vitiate the federal system, but they can pass any law that doesn't within boundaries of their own condominium. The only difference is, in this instance, the restrictive covenant declarant can't come into the state and tell it what to
do. And Mr. Brady, but for that structure that you've just outlined, how could we have planned communities in this state?
You couldn't. And frankly, it's not only planned communities, but every real estate subdivision in this state is done this way. I mean, this is the basic building block of real estate development. And unless you have the ability to control the use of the property and to assess for the use of the total property for all those who enjoy their benefits, you can't have that development.
Mr. Brady, court refused to give you extra time, but it gave you extra time. Maybe more than you originally asked for.
I apologize for being Irish.
No, it was the court's questions when the red light was on. That's fine.
Thank you. I guess I'll see the rest of Mr. Nielsen and shut down.
Exactly.
Very gracious.
Mr. Nielsen, representing the Wisconsin Realtors Association, for the amicus in this case.
Madam Chief Justice and Justices, distinguished colleagues and counsel. I am also for the amicus curiae, Wisconsin Realtors Association. I do thank Mr. Brady and the court for giving me this time. The WRA does ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision, which correctly ruled that the Geneva National Community Association, the governance body for the entire development, is not subject to Chapter 703, and specifically not subject to that portion of 703.15, which requires that the declarant in a condominium or the developer in non-condominium property cede control of the association, the governance body, within either 3 years or 10 years, depending on whether or not the condominium is expandable. None of the condominiums, by the way, in this project are expandable, so we're talking about a 3-year turnover of control provision. There is a strong public policy in this state in regard to real estate, perhaps the most important, that vested property rights, which are created in documents which are in the public records and which grant and reserve powers in real estate, shall not be divested without the actions of the parties in whom they are vested or divested. There is no public policy favoring judicial intervention in an established governance structure on any piece of real estate in order to determine that some rights that are vested in these people should be divested, that those people should be divested, and that those same rights should be turned over to other people. The exact premise that the petitioners bring to this court is that if a person embarks on developing a large piece of land, and then he decides, and as the Court of Appeals put it, a private quasi-town, and if some of that land becomes a condominium, and if the developer chooses to have an association which governs the entire development, then that association, which governs the entire development, must be turned over to the condominium owners at the end of 3 years, in this case, or 10 years if it's an expandable condominium that the developer creates as any part of the development. And why is this? There's really only, you sort it all out, all of this talk about restrictive covenants, which frankly I don't think is even the correct doctrine to apply here. Sort out all the issues about Chapter 703. There's only one reason why the master governance organization has to be turned over to those people who have bought units in condominiums within 3 years. And that is because they're in condominiums. That is the whole premise that the petitioners have brought to the court in various forms. You've heard counsel, learned counsel and my friend this morning say that he takes both positions, that the master declaration, which is really a governance section that he's concerned about, is under Chapter 703, that it is actually a Chapter 703 declaration of condominium, takes that position, but also takes the position that the provisions of the master declaration having to do with the governance body for the entire development are in contradiction to the rights that are vested in his clients because they are condominium unit owners. He takes both positions. Doesn't matter which position he takes, though, because his bottom line position is that after 3 years, on a master plan development, which, to take Justice Prosser's, okay, so a guy owns all of this land and he's paid a lot of money for it. This is the expensive land. And part of this land he decides to turn into a condominium. At the end of 3 years, after having declared that condominium, even if he has been unable to do anything else with any of the rest of his property, if there is a master association to govern all this, all the roads and all the utilities and all the stuff that's supposed to happen in the future, that association now that controls, that governs, must be ceded to those people who have bought from him, which would be only those people in that condominium because that's the only property that's been sold. And maybe only half of that has been sold. All of the control over all this land must be ceded to those people who have bought in that property. Why? Because he happened to make that regime a condominium. There are a lot of governance associations that affect real estate. We have cooperatives in the state. We don't have a statute about cooperatives. We have no statute whatsoever that talks about cooperative regimes and what the governance is. We have subdivisions, thousands of them in the state, perhaps tens of thousands. There isn't one statute that talks about the governance regime at a subdivision. We have lots of other kinds of regimes in this state. None of them have any statutory provision for governance other than condominiums. So Mr. Hessian's clients have bought into a condominium. There are condominiums at Geneva National, so they say Chapter 703 applies. The reason that WRA, as amicus, has brought to the attention of this court the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act is that that act, which is a model act for condominiums, subdivisions, and cooperatives, also has one section, Section 2-123, that talks about master plan communities. And the most interesting thing about 2-123, which, by the way, the petitioners really don't address, is it says under 2-123D, the only real estate in a master plan community which is subject to this act, that is subject to the governance rules about condo associations, is units that have been declared or which have been offered for sale under sub C of this section. Other real estate that is or may become part of the master plan community is only subject to other law and to any other restrictions and limitations that appear of record. Now please notice the subtlety of this statement. In section 2-123, which is D, which is talking about master plan communities, this law, which has been adopted by Ann Kusel after much thought with the help of people who practice in many states that have master plan communities, it says that the only application of the condo law that they have created as a model is as to that property that has been declared a condominium. So in other words, the law just doesn't apply to the rest of the land that's part of the master plan community. The only law that applies is that private law which has been established, as it says specifically.
Counsel?
Yes.
If language in a covenant is clear and specific, can there ever be a separate reasonableness challenge?
Madam Justice, I have a problem with the idea of discussing this in terms of restrictive covenants. What we're talking about is a governance organization or a governance plan. There are two levels at Geneva National. There have to be. As Justice Gableman has pointed out, we have, as the Chief Justice has pointed out, we have the umbrella association. And then we have, in this case, we have a master condominium association in which all of the condominiums are governed. There isn't, the petitioners have not challenged one thing that has been done by the master association for the condominiums. And until today, I haven't heard anything that they have suggested that the master association has done to actually affect the property rights in the condominiums. All right.
I'm not so much concerned about the facts, whether they've challenged this or not challenged that. We're being asked, as I understand it, to come up with a rule of law for all cases for all the people of the state of Wisconsin. And that rule of law, as I understand that's being advanced, is if the language in the covenant, the restrictive covenant, is clear and unambiguous, then no one can challenge that language regardless of the reasonableness of it. Now, that might be a good rule of law, or that might not be a good rule of law, and that's what I want to ask about. Is that a good rule of law for us to embrace for all of the citizens in all of the developments in this state?
In all contracts.
In all contracts. The only reason I made my last point is to say that I think what we were talking about is not a restrictive covenant, like you can't build a gas station on this piece of land. We're talking about provisions in a common interest community providing for the governance of that community. The Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act,
which we have not adopted in this state.
Which we have not adopted. The only reason we bring it up is because in Section 6.19 of that act, they say in those states that don't have a provision about master plan communities, it will be instructive or some guidance to the court in dealing with a master plan community. We don't need Section 2.1-3 to have master plan communities. But this is what then the comment 2-123 says. It says the drafters also expect that the common law doctrines of good faith and unconscionability will continue to be applied by the courts in appropriate circumstances to impose subjective limitations on developer practices. And it cites a case from Massachusetts from 1981 holding that a declarant had to surrender control of an association to unit owners after a reasonable time. Now, is there a conscionability standard as to the actions of a developer of real estate? I believe that there is, yes. But what we're talking about, what the petitioners have asked this court to do, is to void and to nullify provisions in a written document because they say certain things have been done by the current holder of those rights, which they think are unreasonable. There's been no trial about conscionability of the actions. There have been only these scattered references to certain things that they believe the developer has done. But in any event, this lawsuit is not about conscionability or about damages caused by a bad action by the developer. What Mr. Hessian said very plainly today, what he asked this court to do is strike all of Article 9 and portions as yet identified, I think frankly, of Articles 4, 5, and 11. Why? Because they're not reasonable, and to answer Justice Rogensack's point as to reasonableness, when do we determine whether things are reasonable or not? It has to be at the time things are drafted. So, they have asked the court, in light of certain things that have occurred in the 19 years since the declaration was put of record, to say that now certain provisions in it, but specifically as to the control of the governing body, that those must be struck and that the entire development must be turned over to those people who have bought.
in the domestic relations law, you look at reasonableness from both the time of the drafting and then the time that the issues arise. You say here you just look at it original drafting.
As to the reasonableness of the covenant, of the covenant or the governance agreement itself, yes. If you're, because there's a difference, isn't there, in determining the reasonableness of someone's action in carrying out their duties and their responsibilities under a document, as opposed to determining the reasonableness of the provisions themselves. What counsel is really asking is that because there are certain powers that could be abused here, that those powers must be taken away and struck as a matter of law. So, section 2.123 is pretty important for this court as a matter of guidance. That same section of the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act says, the period of declaring control of the association from master plan community terminates in accordance with any conditions specified in the declaration or otherwise at the time the declarant, in a recorded instrument, and after giving written notice to all the unit owners, voluntarily surrenders all rights to control the activities. What the drafters of the Uniform Act said is that there is no way to put a time frame on this. The comment says that a master plan community is expected to take decades to develop. There's a little irony in that we are here about this master plan community today, in today's turbulent times, because real estate isn't selling today. The petitioners suggest that perhaps the developer of this property hasn't sold it because it just wants to remain in power, as Mr. Hessian put it. I would suggest that, and the comments to the Uniform Act state very plainly, that no developer wishes to remain entitled to property. It develops in order to sell. So the automatic impetus on all sides is for the developer to release control as quickly as it can sell it. But in a master plan community, which is a very large development, or a series of developments, a quasi-town, it is impossible to predict at the beginning how long it will take, and there will be many machinations and many zoning changes that the developer has to deal with. So there is no time frame set by the Uniform Act because it's impossible to do so. So to answer Justice Prosser's question one more time, actually, about can there be any conflict between a restrictive covenant and the declaration of a condominium? There's no automatic conflict whatsoever. Is there any conflict that has been that is found in the declaration for this master association with the concept of condominium ownership? There isn't anything that contradicts in those documents. And so WRA would posit that the Court of Appeals did get it correctly and that there is nothing for this court to do in order to strike provisions of the master declaration. Thank you for this time.
If I may, it is just not clear to me what is being argued. The opposing counsel is saying that the 1,600 or most of the 1,600 acres falls under Chapter 703. You disagree with that. A slightly different argument is that the restrictive covenant vitiates the provisions of Chapter 703, notwithstanding the fact that almost everything in those 1,600 acres is a condominium, one kind or another. Now, the Court of Appeals talks about this is a master plan community. It's this big thing. We can't tie down the visionaries with little minutia and turn over all of this power and all this money and all this responsibility to individual owners of condominium units. And there's a tremendous appeal to that. My question is, suppose you have the same kind of restrictive covenants filed before a very small condominium unit. What is to say that that doesn't supersede Chapter 703? I just don't think I understand the answer.
Justice Prosser, this is why I talked about governing bodies. There is nothing inconsistent between putting use restrictions on property. You will not have gas stations here. You will use this property as residential. It will have so many square feet. Nothing inconsistent with that as a document and having property then declared to be a condominium. So I think it was Justice Ziegler who asked which trumps or which controls in this situation. And Mr. Brady gave a very good technical answer. The first document, which is recorded, technically trumps the other. But the question you're really asking is there anything inconsistent between the two things, having the two things on the same property? In fact, not. Almost every condominium declaration has use restrictions in it.
In this case, there is a conflict, the 85%, the 10 years. We have been at a loss to find a conflict in, and you're not giving us one, where the restrictive covenant conflicts with Chapter 703. Right?
Yes, that's correct.
And when it conflicts, which one governs? When you just have a small piece of land with a condo, only one condo.
Chief Justice, this court has decided cases about the proper carrying out or fulfillment of the requirements of Chapter 703. For example, when a declarant attempts to expand a condominium after the time for expansion has passed, the attempted expansion is invalid. If inside a condominium a developer were to create an association and created a turnover provision from the developer to the unit owners, which did not meet the statute, then of course the statute would control.
They would have done that in the restrictive covenant.
They would have done that in the declaration for the condominium.
I know, but we want to get it outside the condominium 703 in a separate document, just like you've got it here.
Well, that is why I keep stressing Section 2-123 as to master plan communities, which says that the Condominium Act, the Model Act, only applies to those portions of the master plan community that have actually been declared to be condominiums. The balance is not under Chapter 703.
There is no balance in Justice Prosser's example, I don't think. Is that right?
Let me try once more. I own this desk. I want to develop. Maybe I'll develop two condominiums on that desk. Can I have a restrictive covenant that will permit me to develop condominiums but not have to follow Chapter 703? I want to run this thing forever.
In order for it to be a condominium, there must be a declaration under 703.12.
Sure. Yeah.
The declaration, and that is the statement that this property shall be owned under the terms of Chapter 703, our condominium law. And so in order for you to say that this property will be a condominium, you must record a declaration saying so. So, and then all of the property that is described in the declaration is in owned under the condominium ownership.
But the gardens that he has, the playground for the kids that he has, this is really a sticky condo. The common roadways that everybody in the condos use. He's saying that is in, what is your community association?
And
he's going to set up the community association, and he and his family members and only the good friends who can be trusted are going to run the community association. And if any of them turn out not to be trusted, he's going to get rid of them. Right? He wants exactly the same thing as you've done here, and he wants to know, is that going to be okay? That's how I hear your question.
If all of those amenities are within the condominium, then they are common elements.
Can I get them out of the condominium?
I'm sorry?
Can't I get them out of the condominium?
No.
Well, here you have amenities that are not a condominium.
That's correct.
How did you do it?
By declaring only portions of this large development as condominium.
Well, he wants to declare only portions of that desk a condo.
Counselor, isn't this a little bit like local rules? State of Wisconsin has got rules.
Then the municipality comes in. Municipality sets up other rules within the confines of the municipality. Those rules take precedent over individual development, correct? We also have regional planning, but within the regional planning, you also have municipalities. So what I hear you saying is there's just a layering. The first layer is kind of like the basic rules of the game. Then on parts of this first layer, there are condominiums, but there are also provisions for single-family dwellings and other things. So, you know, if the rules don't apply to the condominiums, are they still going to apply now to the single-family dwellings, or are these generalized overall first-layer rules, which is what I hear you saying, and the condominium then, within the footprint of the condominium, carves out the rules for that condominium. But the next condominium may not like the rules in the first condominium, and in their footprint, they carve out different rules for that condominium, all being subject to the essential rules of the game to start with, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. The rules of the game don't have to conform to 703,
right?
Like the 85%, 75% rule or the 10-year rule.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hershen, you have 5 minutes. I mean, but I say five, but you can see how generous we are with time. I'm a real strict instructionist about time, as is the rest of the court.
I want to address a number of the issues that were just spoken to by Mr. Nielsen and Mr. Brady. Mr. Nielsen made an interesting point about how there can be use restrictions, like no gas stations. There was a terrific use restriction in this. It said no timeshares. And you know what the declarant did? He amended it 15 years later, allowing timeshares, taking away value from the individual unit owners, and no longer allowing them to control the use of their property. Now, Mr. Brady says that the declarant doesn't have the authority to go into these individual condominium associations, but I would like to direct the court's attention to Article 9.04. It reads, "The declarant reserves the right to review and in the sole and absolute discretion of declarant approve the declaration of condominium, articles of incorporation, declaration of covenants, conditions and restrictions, bylaws and rules and regulations of any condominium and any condominium association created for any portion of the property, and to also so review and approve all amendments to all such documents and in its sole and absolute discretion, and no such documents or amendments shall be effective unless and until approved in writing by the declarant." The declarant has control of the individual condominium associations by virtue of the language contained in Article 9.04. The declarant has the authority to approve and deny any of the individual changes that those condominium associations wish to have. So under Justice Rogensack's example, it's not possible for one to prefer a certain kind of restriction and the other one to have it different, because the declarant has the authority to make that change. That is the fundamental problem with Article 9.
Does the declarant have the authority after the condominium documents are filed to go in and say that the rules will not be as they are right now within the condominium? Say they set it up for no rentals in their condominium association. That's in their bylaws. You can't rent anything. Does the declarant have the power to come in and amend their bylaws and say, yes, you can rent as much as you want?
Under Article 9.04, the declarant has the ability to approve or deny amendments.
Right, so they can't amend it contrary to the wishes of the condominium owners.
Correct? In the individual associations, that's correct. But the associations also cannot make amendments without the approval of the declarant.
Right.
So if the associations wish to have rentals, the declarant has the authority to take that power away from them. I also think it's important we address the issue related to whether or not pure contract law should be applied to this case. There are two specific reasons that this is not the average sort of contract that should be entitled to contract law interpretation. First, Wisconsin Statute Section 703 provides specific protections around which the declarant should not be allowed to contract. If that is the precedent set in this case, then individuals have the ability to contract around otherwise legitimate protections allowed for. Additionally, the declarant used the protections of 703 to market this property. They provided individuals with copies of the Declaration of Condominium, and the individuals understood that the properties were subject to Section 703, and therefore they were entitled to the protections of Section 703. Now, Mr. Nielsen also talked about protecting the long-term interests of the declarant. There are a variety of ways in which the declarant's interests are protected. The developer's interests are important, but only one part of the puzzle. The restatement nicely sets out all of the interests that must be weighed, including the interests of almost 1,000 property owners. And that's really the determination we ask the court to make today. After 19 years, after the reasonable period of time set out by the Wisconsin legislature has passed, what determination needs to be made in weighing the interests of one declarant versus 1,000 unit owners who have a legitimate long-term financial interest in the value of the properties of Geneva National?
You know, I still have a basic problem. Suppose you win. Suppose this is violative of 703, or if it's not, then this whole governance issue is unreasonable because it gives one entity this power. I don't know what you have left. You're attacking Article 4 and Article 9, and Article 5, and those articles deal with the community association. They deal with the trust, and then they deal with the declarant. And if they're gone, I mean, they're big articles. What's left that governs all of this property?
What we ask the court to strike, Madam Chief Justice, are the portions that allow for declarant control. In Article 4, for instance, the composition of the community association gives the declarant 4 votes ad infinitum. We ask the court to strike
those
4 votes.
You want the court to go through each of these articles and decide which ones give declarant control and therefore should be excised, and then you think there's a working governance left. Is that
yes.
Your position?
I certainly don't wish to assign the court work to excise each of those. We think that if the court were to strike declarant control, that there is a working document that remains. A community association remains. It is made up of a member of the single family residential units, the multiple family residential units, the golf course, and the commercial development.
Does it have to go down to the trial court so it strikes the appropriate language so everybody knows what's happening?
That would be one possible result. If the court were to determine that declarant control should no longer be allowed, the circuit court could make a determination as to which provisions allow for declarant control.
Counsel, didn't you discuss Star Direct earlier and the first time you were up to that? How do you reconcile what you just said with Star Direct?
Well, I think what I just said is that portions are severable such that the remainder of the restrictive covenant survives. And I think that is consistent with Star Direct.
I think in Star Direct we could have just gone through and taken out a couple of lines in each covenant and then had an enforceable document.
I think that the blue pencil rule would have allowed that, such that the court would have had the ability to leave the remainder of the document in place, yes.
But I think what I heard you say, counsel, is you're asking the court to take away developer control of this planned community.
We're asking the court to take away developer control of the community association. That's correct. Now, keep in mind, Justice Gableman, that the developer continues to have votes where it continues to own real property. What that does is it properly weighs the interests of the declarant with the interests of those unit owners. And now the developer's interests are properly aligned with those of the unit owners because it has the same rights. It votes its ownership interest of the property.
And you put the trust not in the declarant's control, but in somebody else's control.
That's correct. We think the trust can continue to operate and that the directors of the trust are elected by the individual unit owners. I see that my time is up. Thank you very much for allowing us to present today. We ask that you rule in favor of the plaintiff petitioners.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Mr. Hessian, Mr. Brady, and Mr. Nielsen for their arguments today on this condominium case with complicated facts, a long agreement, and relating to not only Chapter 703, but basic contract rules. That ends our hearing in 088P10, Solovitz versus Ford, Geneva National, and others. The court will reconvene in the conference room at 1:30, unless it decides to come back earlier. Thank you.